You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Rhea Fried.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, book one by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, book two in the series. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in the chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Rhea Fry on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book called Because You're Mine, and it is an amazing read. I've had a copy for a few weeks now, and it was one of those that I was sitting on the couch thumbing through and accidentally got 200 pages in before I realized what was going on. So thank you for an amazing book, and thank you for joining me today, Rhea.
Well, thank you for having me and for reading and saying such nice things.
Well, you're very welcome. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Ooh, that's a good one. So I actually grew up with a father who was a writer. He's not a published writer. I always say that he should have been, but we used to write poetry together, and I remember writing a poem with him while we were doing dishes called Soap Suds, and I entered it into a competition, and it won, and I was like, oh, this is really cool. I think I was in maybe third grade or so, and I remember that being a really special moment, thinking like, oh, this is something that could be really fun in the future to do. Because I like to win. Because I'm not competitive at all.
I never would have gone there.
Yeah.
So in third grade, you enter this writing competition and you win. Before that, were there any adults in your life? And we'll accept your father since he obviously was kind of fostering this in you. But were there any other people that noticed this kind of storytelling gene and maybe offered encouragement?
That's a good question. I mean, I always was a reader. I think that was where the love came first. My parents taught me to read through TV Guide. You remember TV Guides?
Oh, yeah.
So that was where I learned to read. And I had a first grade teacher who was such an important person in my life who really fostered that. She could tell I really loved to read. I really loved to write stories and tell stories. And she would allow me to read to the class. And just kind of celebrated that. So I would say more in a teacher capacity. I really noticed that early on.
I love to hear those stories because, you know, we talk a lot on the show about those kind of dark, lonely days of being a writer where, you know, you're all alone in a room and it's just you and this stupid story that won't seem to go anywhere. And it's those little things that we look back on, those moments of encouragement and inspiration that, you know, cost nothing to the teacher or, you know, adult who does it, but last a lifetime. So
absolutely,
always like to highlight those people that do that for kids. Cause I think it's so important.
I agree.
So after the third grade, kind of pinnacle, where do you go from there? Does the writing bug keep nagging at you?
Yeah. I mean, I've always written something, like even if it's not, you know, to make money. I was a huge letter writer, and it's one of the things that I really mourn for children today is that they don't really write handwritten notes to their friends or to, you know, people they might be romantically interested in. It's all about texting, which sucks. But I was always writing letters, writing poetry, writing little novels that I would hand write, you know, in journals, and also kept a journal every single day of my young life up through my teenage years, which is a huge mistake. No one should have all of that chronicled. There's just some things you should not write down or have to go back and read later in life. But and then I decided to go to college for creative writing at Columbia in Chicago. They had a really cool creative writing program. And I just always surrounded myself with words, with reading, in any capacity that I could.
In studying at Columbia, what was your intention with getting that degree? How did you see your future playing out?
Yeah, I mean, I was always really into school, and it's funny. My husband and I homeschool my daughter now, but I, you know, I'm salutatorian of high school and valedictorian of my college, and just was like such an overachiever, put a lot of stress on myself. And I remember when I wanted to go to Columbia, because I got some scholarships from other places, and I remember just walking into this classroom. There was like duct tape on the floors and just nothing. I mean, there was nothing really special about the classrooms, but I could tell that the teachers there were super passionate about just writing and literature and books. And I was like, whoa, can I really sit for 4 hours in a class and just talk about books that I love and create stories, you know? So I started out actually as a journalism major, and I switched to fiction writing and ended up writing a really shitty novel that got published before I graduated college. I don't really broadcast that because it was it was pretty bad. But, you know, my goal was always to try to get a book published. I think I wanted one so badly that I didn't spend enough time really thinking about crafting a story the right way. So I kind of shelved that. Like after I graduated with this degree, I morphed into nonfiction and started writing for magazines, writing for newspapers. I served as a journalist on 3 death row cases. I worked a lot, you know, with inmates. I was a content manager, a blogger. So I kind of worked my way around doing the one thing that I really wanted to do, which was writing novels. I ended up writing a bunch of health and wellness books. So it's funny. I just kind of danced around the thing that I went to college for and the thing that I really wanted to do. I think just because I wasn't really ready to sit down and do it, or I didn't feel like I had the right story to tell.
Well, let me ask you this, shifting gears to writing nonfiction and, you know, getting completely out of that brain space of writing novels for a while. Do you think that that helped to mature you as a writer? Do you feel like you picked up any tools specifically from writing completely differently than you had been that then prepared you to do what you're doing now?
I do. I mean, nonfiction is such a it's such a different beast. And I actually have a business where I write nonfiction book proposals for clients to land them book deals. And it's such a wonderful way to organize your mind and organize your idea, actually. So it's such a roadmap. And I'm not a good, I've never been a great like outliner for novels, but you give me the tools to write a book proposal and to really see that idea through. I think it helps you write such a clear, cohesive book that sometimes you don't extend the same set of tools when you write a novel. So I think that really helped me. It helped me with deadlines. It helped me with really distilling down large amounts of information into sometimes really short, just short articles or, you know, I just had to focus more. And I think that's helped me translating that actually into writing fiction and learning about the business. I mean, I always say that to writers, you know, you always get asked like, what's a piece of information you give to writers? And it's not to write or to read what you want to write. It's to understand this business. So many people want to be published. They don't know how the business works. They don't understand the contracts when they get them. They don't understand how the money works or what you need to do to sell books. So I think all of that served me really well for this
or
journey.
What you need to do or what you need to know about telling a story.
Yes, or telling a story. Yeah, the important thing there.
Yeah, some people run so, you know, headlong into being published that they don't take the time to work on the craft and it shows.
Yes. Yeah, well, yeah. And I mean, I felt like that when I wrote Not Her Daughter, my debut that came out in 2018, because I had not touched fiction in well over a decade when I sat down to write it. So in some ways I was like, who am I to think that I can sit down and actually remember how to do this?
Right. Right. Well, you studied journalism and switched, but you said you worked in journalism and in covering trials and things like that. Did I'm always fascinated by journalists who start writing fiction and what things they picked up from being a journalist. Because, you know, if a story happens and someone's covering that story, there may be 10 people covering the same story and they all come away with one of two things, either just a bare-boned list of events that happened, or they come up with a different perspective and a story on that story. And does being a journalist help to sharpen those skills of paying attention to the things around you and looking for the little details that will help you in writing fiction to immerse someone into your world?
100%. You know, I think being a journalist actually helped me answer and ask why. I think the why is so important. You know, in the thriller genre or suspense genre, which I'm kind of in, sometimes it's about how, you know, like, oh, a crime happened. Like, how did it happen? But I'm much more interested in the why and asking questions and understanding why people do the things that they do. You know, I mean, I've sat in a room with a convicted murderer, you know, chatting about the weather. And it's, you know, it's just so interesting to me that, you know, underneath that, the surface and just the light conversation is someone who potentially, you know, did this horrible thing. So I'm super interested in how we get from being, you know, just kind of going along with the flow to doing these terrible, dark things. So for me, being a journalist, especially around the kinds of things that I was covering, there was always a little bit of a sinister undertone there, but the why is 100% the most valuable piece of information that I could have taken from that.
Well, in working in nonfiction for a while, and did you feel like you were kind of gun shy about coming back to fiction? Did you, when you wrote Not Her Daughter, did you know that it was time, or did you just kind of have to take a leap of faith?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I mean, so I wrote like 4 health and wellness books that all got published by traditional publishers. But at the time, this was kind of right when social media, I feel like, was getting started. I did not have the author platform that is needed to really sell on a great level for nonfiction. I mean, today, especially, it's all about your author platform, who's following you, where your readership is, what you're already doing. So for me, I just didn't feel like I had those tools at the time, and I wanted to go back to fiction, but I was like, oh, I just don't, you know, I don't know if I have the story or I have an idea for a novel. And then the way that Not Her Daughter came about is just so crazy and still one of my favorite stories. But I had an idea for this novel. I knew I wanted to write about, you know, a little girl who gets kidnapped from her mother in order to save her. I wanted to kind of take this idea for a reverse kidnapping. And that really started to kind of play in my mind after I became a parent and I started paying attention to how just parents behaved with their children in public. I feel like we've all been there where maybe you see a questionable exchange and you might want to say something, but it's like, well, that's not really any of my business. And I remember being in an airport. I was working 3 jobs at the time and I was traveling for one of them. And I saw this exchange between a mother and daughter that was just pretty violent, pretty emotional, very verbally and physically abusive to this little girl who was decked out all in red. And her name was Emma, which is so crazy because I knew that the character in my book was going to be named Emma. So I took that as a sign. And I just remember wanting to save this little girl. And so I went home, and that very week I quit 2 jobs and I gave myself 8 weeks to write this book. I said, if I don't do this now, I'm not going to do it. And I wrote it in 4 weeks and didn't give myself a plan B. I didn't really question, you know, if this was going to get published. I knew I was going to get an agent and that it was going to get published. And thank God it worked out.
Wow.
It was crazy. It was a whirlwind.
So you gave yourself 8 weeks.
I did.
You know, a lot of traditionally published authors put out a novel a year and,
yes,
and, you know, have this schedule laid out.
Yep.
You know, there are a lot of other authors who are either indie published or hybrid publishing and maybe put out 2 or 3 books a year. And that is considered prolific and, you know, and really got the wheels turning. To expect to write a book in 8 weeks. You set that goal for yourself.
I did.
What was your expectation? Did you know that you were going to sit down and have, you know, a set amount of time every day, and I'm going to crank out this many words? Like, how did you set yourself up for success to do that?
Yeah, great question. I don't even know. It was like an out of body experience almost, because, you know, my daughter was at home at the time and I still had this job. The reason I gave myself 8 weeks is I had this content management job that I was getting paid really well for. So I was like, oh, well, I'm just going to kind of use that, pretend that it's an advance and that I'm getting paid to write. And I just took pockets of time when I could. And I actually think my former work, I've always been, you know, like a content manager or a senior editor or handling large amounts of copy and content at one time. So I knew that I could work really fast and I knew I could write quickly, but it was probably writing every day. And I mean, I would sit and sometimes write, you know, have a huge word count day, and other days were, you know, spent editing. But yeah, in 4 weeks, it was done and like ready to pitch, which is crazy. I still don't know how that happened. And, you know, if I had known how long the process was actually going to take in terms of, you know, getting the book out, I would have spent, more time with it up front. But yeah, it was so much fun. I've never had more fun because, you know, there wasn't any pressure really other than my own pressure. And there was no real deadline. There was no real risk. And I think that that's the beauty of when you write a first novel, is just, it's all yours and you can do with it whatever you want.
What's really fun is, you know, there's some writing projects that demand an outline and careful preparation and,
sure.
And you know, a lot of pre-planning that people tend to overlook when they say they wrote a book fast, and they don't tell you about the 5 or 6 weeks of pre-planning that went into
sure.
it. And then there are some times where the writer madness just comes on you and the story just kind of erupts out of you, and you're just, you know, hanging on to the keyboard as
yes.
you get the words out.
Yeah.
How much did you know about the story ahead of time? I know you talked about the observations and you see some things that just kind of, you know, sparked things, but did you know where this story of yours was going ahead of time?
Yeah. I mean, I had been thinking about it for a few weeks. And when I saw, I actually took the real mother in the airport and the real daughter in the airport and created these characters of Amy and Emma based around these actual people. But I remember seeing them and then like, oh, that's what I want to do. I kind of changed where I wanted the story to go, but I always knew how I wanted it to end, even though my editor changed it and it's different than the way I wanted it to end. But I did kind of have a vague idea of where it was going. I knew how it was going to start. I knew how it was going to end. And then of course, you know, it was just figuring out how to get there. So I did do a lot of, I think thinking about your idea is so important as a writer. And I, you know, I take walks a lot during the day because I, again, work on all of these client book proposals and my own stuff. So I need that processing time. And I think that that's actually where good ideas come from and where you work through, you kind of troubleshoot. It's not always on the page. It's when you step away from it.
Right. The second book, Because You're Mine, which is the new book that is out today. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Book launch day. But we talk a lot on the show about the gift of anonymity and that first book. And like you talked about, no one was putting pressure on you but yourself.
Sure.
No one was expecting this book yet. No one, you know, there's no outside pressure. But you know, then you have that book come out, it's successful, and you know, another book contract comes along, and now you're on a schedule and people know that you're doing something. What's that like with book two?
Yeah, it's very different. And I mean, since then I got another 2-book deal with St. Martin's Press. So it'll be 4 books. I will be on the book a year, as you were talking about earlier. So there is that pressure, you know, you have less time to just kind of sit around and think about your ideas because, you know, there is a production schedule that you have to stick to. So going into book two, actually, when I got my book deal, it was a 2-book deal, though we didn't know what the second book was going to be. So I initially pitched Because You're Mine is kind of more women's fiction. It was very, very different. And then we really changed it. We changed it several times, actually. So the process of it was very different. It was more kind of put together, more a lot more ideas tossed around, and again, sticking to that schedule. So I definitely felt more pressure with this one. Everyone jokes about that, like your sophomore effort and the pressures that come with it. And yeah, now you have readers expecting something from you. And what if they hate it? Which there's always going to be people that hate it, that love it and hate it. And that's totally fine. So yeah, it was a different experience, but I mean, it was still great, but it's just crazy that in less than a year, you know, two books kind of are in my hands. And then next year there will be another one, and next year there'll be another one. So it's pretty wild.
It is. The new book, The Truth Will Set You Free, But the Lies Keep You Safe.
Yes.
What was the inspiration for this book?
You know, when I first got the idea for this book, I was friends with a few other women who were also raising only children. And I remember we were sitting in the park one day and we just started having this conversation, like, God forbid something happened to one of us, but what would happen to our kids? You know, a lot of people are like, oh, your kid would go to your spouse or to a family member. But as we started talking about it, we were like, wow, wouldn't it make more sense for your child to be with a friend who is also a parent, who's kind of in it, your kids know each other. So we started kind of getting into this conversation. And I just had an idea for this book about kind of these four girlfriends. They're in various places in their life. They decide to go away for a girls' getaway in the mountains, and one of them dies. And it's just kind of the aftermath of what happens. All these secrets, lies, these pasts kind of come out. And, you know, the moral of the story is really, you know, how well do we ever really know our friends? Because again, it goes back to that why. I'm just so interested in the version of ourselves that we present to the world, especially with, you know, social media and making our lives look all perfect. But then often there are things lurking beneath the surface that no one knows. And that's really, really what this book is kind of all about.
Well, in Because You're Mine, the new book, Lee is a single mother and she is parenting a son named Mason.
Yes.
And Mason is a special child. He's on the spectrum, and that brings about all sorts of challenges. And, you know, when we open the story, we see Lee as this kind of everyday hero, and she's got, you know, the day planned out. She's got a schedule for everything. She's right on time. And then we start to see the cracks and kind of, like you said, the story that we put forward versus kind of the real story. What did you do for research for the Mason character, and how do you make that believable, while building empathy with the audience?
Sure. I mean, I feel like, you know, autism is a subject that we're talking more and more about. And yes. I wanted to show a character that's kind of celebrated. I've had several readers tell me that Mason is their favorite character. And he's not fully autistic. He has something called sensory processing disorder. So he has aversions to certain, you know, sounds or fabrics or foods, very particular about certain things. And I picked that particular disorder just because there's such a wide array of symptoms with it that I was thinking about the reader in terms of, you know, if I chose autism in general to talk about, I knew that no matter how I did it, I probably wouldn't get it just right. So I wanted to pick something that was a little bit more lax in terms of just the symptoms and the character, so you could really focus on the character and not this disorder that he had or not this disability that he has. But he's a real character, you know, with real feelings. And I have a friend whose son has sensory processing disorder. And I also talked to an occupational therapist, and she was really kind of chatting with me about just Mason in general. And, you know, I made him pretty sarcastic, but he's very blunt. He's very honest. And I just thought, you know, he was just a fun character to celebrate and to write about. And his mom, does kind of come unhinged. You know, she can't seem to just keep it all together. I mean, she's trying to, but you know, Mason really sees her and calls her out on certain things. So their relationship's pretty interesting.
Yeah, Mason's kind of my spirit animal.
Yes,
in a
totally.
Lot of ways, I think.
Love Mason.
He's
yes.
Yeah, he's the person in a lot of ways that a lot of us wish we could be.
Yes, and, absolutely. You
know,
no filter.
Yeah. Yeah, no filter, you know, and if we didn't have all the societal stuff that comes with it, you know, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Another aspect of the story is because Lee and Mason do have this relationship that is, you know, very special, but very protective from Lee's point of view. And Mason doesn't do well with new people. And then you introduce a character into that to upset the whole dynamic. What was the process of working through adding Noah to the story?
Yeah, I mean, so the book is told from three different points of view. It's Lee, Lee's best friend, Grace, who's also raising an only son. And then there's Noah, who is Mason's occupational therapist and homeschool teacher. You know, Noah, again, when we first started this process, he was kind of a different character completely. But I should say, or highlight that, you know, each of these characters too is suffering a loss. Lee lost a sibling. She lost her mother, but her mother was pregnant, so she never got to be a sibling. So she lost a brother before she got to be a sibling. Grace has lost a sister, and then Noah has lost his brother Wyatt. And so that kind of connects all of these characters too through their loss. And Noah, because his brother was also autistic, he seems to just have this special, easy bond with Mason that Lee kind of doesn't. He just seems to get him and understand him. And I think that, you know, Mason reminds Noah a lot of his brother. And then Lee is also romantically interested in Noah. So that kind of does screw up the dynamic a little bit because Lee's focusing so much on not being romantically interested in anyone and making her life all about her son instead of just living her life and having a son.
Well, this wouldn't be a proper suspense thriller if there weren't some secrets.
Of course,
and some,
yes.
Some underhandedness going on. In writing, and we're not going to get into all that because we don't want to spoil the story.
Yes.
Because this book is brand new today and we want people to go get their copy. But in writing this book, as opposed to the first one, did you learn things from writing that first novel that you brought into your writing process for Because You're Mine?
Great question. I mean, yes, I still think as writers and published writers get this, you know, you always want to go back and like change everything once your books are out into the world. But, you know, I feel like because I'm in this domestic suspense genre that having some sort of empathy for your characters is very important. People kind of, even if they didn't like the characters and not her daughter, they still saw themselves in them. They still questioned, you know, their actions. So bringing in kind of the character, building a world around these characters, I brought with me into this book, though this book is much, it has more twists and turns. And my hope for this book was that if you read it and then get to the last page and kind of know the truth, if you went back and read it, you would have a completely different experience once you know the truth. So that was really interesting to try to orchestrate, keeping things from the reader as the writer, but having it still feel surprising. I mean, they felt like two different books to me. They felt like two totally different experiences. I tried to, again, build this one more brick by brick. It took a longer period of time than Not Her Daughter. And now going forward, I don't know if you've read this or recommended this to your listeners, but I stumbled upon Save the Cat Writes a Novel by Jessica Brody. And I was like, where was this book? I'm usually not a person to read books like that, but it has been so helpful in just going forward and making sure to hit all of those beats and the plot points at the right times. Because your mind's not a typical, I feel like it's laid out a little bit different than a lot of suspense novels. It's a little bit different. So going forward, I'm really excited to kind of implement some new techniques, I will say.
I am going to reread Because You're Mine, because I want to see if there's a that other experience.
Yeah,
sure. Now that I know everything.
Yeah.
And you are a sneaky, sneaky writer, and I love it, Rhea.
Oh, thank you.
I love the book, Because You're Mine. It's out everywhere now. When you're hearing this, Rhea, if people are just learning about you, want to dig into your other work and follow along for news, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yes, definitely. In terms of social media, I'm on all the platforms, but I really spend the most time on Instagram. My handle is just my name, R-E-A-F-R-E-Y, or you can go to my website, which is the same, rheafry.com. And I have book tour information, newsletter, you know, press about the book, all that fun stuff.
Excellent. Rhea, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning into the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
Midnight struck. The Sandman had come. A few faint notes drifted through the rooms of 417 Gorybrook. The hollow wind testing the weatherproofing. The weak scritch of the persimmon tree against Zeph's window, and the drone of Hedwig's snoring. The old house shifted, creaked, and the shade of Agatha Van Brunt descended from the attic.
"Brahm?" she called.
The ghost paused, collecting herself on the stair. She passed a mirror, but the glass remained empty, reflecting only absence. Agatha would not have recognized herself anyway. She had been beautiful long ago, and still was in her own mind. Not a toothless and wizened specter. Not a blue chalk sketch of a hag half erased from the blackboard of night. She drifted into the master bedroom, disappeared into a shaft of moonbeams, and reappeared on the other side. She stood over Hedwig, listening to him snore. But Hedwig was not Brahm. She needed Brahm. She slipped through the floor into Zeph's bedroom. She stood over him for a long time, listening to the persimmon tree's weak coffin scratch on the window screen.
Brahm?
No, this was not Brahm. Not Brahm, her son. But she loved this boy. So much hidden potential. He reminded her of Dylan, her grandson. Dylan had slept in this room many, many times. But Dylan was dead, never to return. This boy, Zeph, was alive, so alive.
Oh, would that he might remain so forever. Look at him. Who would consign such a handsome lad to the rot of death? Only a very cruel and blind god.
Agatha brushed her spectral lips to Zeph's cheek. He stirred, scratched the spot, and rolled into his pillow. But Zeph was not Brahm. Where?
Oh, Brahm is dead.
She remembered now.
Brahm is dead, and so are Hermanus, my husband, and Hans, my brother, and old Baltus Van Tassel, and Katrina. All dead. Only old Agatha remains, after a fashion, to trouble the world.
Her sense of herself sharpened and returned to her. She searched the rooms for the crane boy. She sensed him. Yes, here was the boy, sleeping fitfully, holding his animal. She extended a hand as if to reach into Jason's chest and take his heart in her talons. The dog woke, sensing Agatha's presence, and growled.
Growl till your voice cracks, cur. I could kill this child myself. I could possess the man or the boy. I could take the butcher knife from the drawer. I could stride through the night in strong male form and dissect this child at my whim.
Something struck her. Something blasted her up and away from the boy. She collected her energies again and tried to re-enter, but could not pass through the walls. When she found her voice, it came as hollow and cold as wind through a tomb.
"Who is here?"
Agatha whispered, and her tone might have withered grass.
"Show yourself."
She waited with growing confusion and anxiety. She threw herself forward and battered the door like a tempest.
"Who is here?"
she cried. But no one answered.